No, hey, I just want to thank you for coming on.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, I know we're neighbors, but, and we're both in the same business, but, you know, we don't really talk too much about cannabis too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how's your instrument going? Are you going to, do it?
I'm slacking, but I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Just dedicating time and just with the schedule I have, trying to find a CFII that can like fly by the wing and give super short notice, you know, like, hey, I got the afternoon open. Usually they're like, oh, I'm booked out 2 weeks. I'm like,
phew. Have you started on it at all or no?
I started doing some of the ground school.
You did?
Yeah. So, on the Shepherd Air, that the pretest with all the answers for like 1200, I probably got 400 to 500. But when it started getting into all the airways and the VOR stuff, when you sent me that link.
Yeah.
I watched that thing 4 or 5 times.
Yeah. Like, it's got like sections and yeah. you gotta follow the process. Did you read the process?
No.
Yeah, you got to stick to that Shepherd Air process. Like it's like,
oh, for the Shepherd Air, yeah, but not on the YouTube tutorials.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go sit with an instructor and literally.
That's what I need. That's what I had to do. I did like 18 days of 10-hour days. 8 to 10-hour days, 18. You not all in a row. I did like 7 days consecutively. And then I did another, you know, 5 days, and then I did another like 5 days and then a few days, so
of all ground school.
Just ground, not ground. I did, probably like half ground about that, one-on-one, and then we went flew and then come back.
I'd say if you're not flying, I don't know how I'd be able to make it practical to where I can kind of memorize everything that I'm learning.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's crazy about the brain. It's weird because I remember I'd go like 5 to 7 days solid of just straight training, 8 to 10 hours, ground school and flying. And then, my brain would be mush.
Yeah.
About at the end of the 7 days, like I'd feel like kind of like in a dream state, and I'd be worried to come back and start flying again because I'd forget things. Right. Cause you're just getting so much when you're doing your instrument IFR, you're getting so much thrown at you. And what I realized, it's like your brain has to heal itself.
Yeah.
It's a trip because I think it just takes, just like a muscle, right? If you're, you know, working out your biceps and you're working out every day, and you don't let your biceps heal, you're not going to get any gains.
Yep. And good analogy.
What I realized getting my IFR, was your brain's the same exact way. You know, you got to give it like that a week or two off and then come back and it like sets in like all the, you know, approaches, whatever you're working on, it okay. sets in.
Okay.
So just hit it.
Yeah. Even after a 2-hour session of ground school online, I'm smoked mentally.
2 hours. That's yeah. about what I like. I last about 2 to 3 hours of just straight ground school.
Of just, yeah.
Yeah. And it's cool that we're, you know, we're neighbors. We're both in cannabis. We're both pilots, right? You both have kids, same age.
Yep.
You know, it's pretty rad.
Yeah, well, I think you got half the neighborhood on to wanting to fly.
Is that what happened?
Oh, yeah. And then I was getting shit from all the boys in the neighborhood. Like, what do you mean you're into bikes and dirt bikes and all this shit? And you're not flying? I'm like, should I be?
Is that how it went down?
Yeah. And then one of my buddies took me out and just instantly we got on the runway and we started throttling up. It's like, you know, put your hands on the yoke and follow me through. And then the second the wheels came off the ground,
yeah,
I was hooked.
Yeah. Getting the IFR is probably the hardest thing I've ever done. Like the most challenging thing I've ever done in life.
Yeah.
You know,
but I'm sure it was rewarding. And like when you're done with that, just the private pilots, when he finally said like, well done, you completed it.
Yeah.
In my mind, you know, I'm just like, where's my Super Bowl ring?
Yeah.
I did it.
Yeah. How long did it take you?
Just over a year.
Yeah. That's what it took me, about a year. How many hours did you?
I think I took the test in like 75 hours.
75. That's
75 to 79 hours.
That's exactly what I did. 75 hours. You could do it with 40, but obviously, you know that,
yeah.
but it took me 75 for my private.
Yeah.
And it took me a year.
I think someone should have be telling people that if you're going to do it, you really need to fly twice a week and get it done in 6 months. Cause if I went a little bit over a week flying, just the motor
lose
skills.
It.
Yeah. You're not fully there, you know, and then you start getting frustrated, you know, one bad landing. And then the second one, you're trying to overcorrect everything, 2 bad landings, 3 bad landings, then just the whole day's, you know, yeah.
I think being a pilot, like it's so challenging and it's not always like riding a bike, right? Like you get right back on the bike, you're good to go. With being a pilot, you don't fly for 2 months. And you got to warm up. You got to get warm up on your calls, warm up on your landings, warm up on your checklist, like just get out in the grind. And it's extremely challenging. That's why I like it. It's just really hard. So
you still get the sweaty hands right before you're about to take off?
Not right now, just because I've been flying so much with my IFR training.
Yeah.
But before that, yeah, absolutely. If I don't fly for 2 months, for sure, dude, I get, sweaty hands. I get a little nervous, like shit. Like, do I remember everything?
Yeah.
But as soon as you take off and you make that left downwind or wherever you're going, you're like, oh, I got this.
Yeah.
Like, I know exactly what I'm doing. It just takes that getting up in the air. And as soon as you're there, you're like, oh, no problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. But before that, it's rough. I heard you had you got into IMC on the way back from Havasu? You had to land in like Palm Springs or something?
Oh, yeah. Our
Aaron told me about that.
Our buddy that got me into flying.
Yep.
It started getting pretty shitty conditions, so we landed in Palm Springs, and then he told me, he's like, climb up, circle around the airport. There's a big opening. Get to 12,000 feet, go over the mountains of the Anza Pass, and then you'll see a break in the clouds right above the airport. Okay. So I did it.
But did you get into IMC?
I started to, but then I descended through the clouds pretty heavy.
Okay.
Right around the Palm Springs area, there was an opening. But when I was coming through Yucca Valley, 29 Palms, I could see maybe 5-10 miles in front of me. And then that depleted pretty quickly. So when I'm breaking through the clouds, I had terrain awareness on. I was like, let's hope we see land sooner than later instead of the side of a mountain.
Yeah. Is the wife cool now that you got a Cirrus?
She don't really like the flying thing too much.
No.
No.
I mean, the plane's got a parachute.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to sell her on that point too, but a little bit of turbulence. She's in the back with a blanket over her head, and she won't even sit in the front seat.
Oh, it's like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But my boy that's 10, he's like super into it.
Yeah.
So it's all right that I have him in the front because he wants to learn. His goal is he wants to get the private pilot's license at 16.
Yeah, that's dope. We have the exact same plane, both G2. Do you have Avidyne or Garmin?
I got the Avidyne.
Yeah, same as me. Do you have 650s or what do you have?
Yeah.
650s.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, you're set.
Yeah, but who doesn't want to upgrade,
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. So your background, you were a pro BMXer for a long time. How did you get into that and how far did you take it?
I think I took that to the highest level that I could. About 7 years old, started racing. By 12 years old, I knew that that's all I wanted to do. Parents didn't make me do any more little league sports. And just being like a one-man marching band out there, getting to do it for myself, getting to travel a little bit, the freedom of kind of like your parents letting you go with other friends and travel. It just stuck with me. Not having to rely on somebody else. It was like, it was one of the coolest experiences, I think, as a kid. Just some of that freedom that you have.
Going up through like the ranks, like how do you, when you're starting at the local BMX track, like totally. Beginner.
Totally.
And then what are the ranks that you have to go through to become the level that you're at?
So they have like novice, inner, expert, and all those are just like a step above like the belts in karate. Certain amount of wins, you get bumped up in classes and then it becomes more challenging. And at the time, at 16 years old, you could turn pro. Some kids between 16 and 18, if they're a top amateur, that's when they start to go pro. And then from there, they start having like World Cups. I think 2008 was when they had the first Olympics for BMX. And that's when everybody in kind of my age bracket, 16 through 20, started trying to leave the amateur classes and go towards racing pro so that everybody could follow the Olympic dream. And that was a pretty cool experience. Just not making the Olympics, but getting to train for it and getting to travel the world and racing some of the World Cups and meeting other young people from all over the world that they're living the dream. And it kind of almost refers to growing. You just, when there's like a bond where someone's got so much love for one aspect of life, the camaraderie is great. Like everyone's super open to being inviting to you, whether it's on their home turf or just kind of telling you like what it is that they're doing or their experiences.
So how far did you race in the World Cups?
Yep. I got a race like Elite Pro. I think I did that for 6-7 years.
And what countries were you traveling to, and how old were you?
I traveled to quite a few countries, and it probably started at 18.
Started at 18?
Yep. And like from 15 to 18, everywhere in the United States, there's like a circuit that travels. Every other weekend, you're flying to someplace, assembling your bike and racing. And then around 18 is when they started, you know, having all these World Cups, and you'd go to different continents and get to compete against people globally.
That's dope.
That's cool.
Yeah. Were you growing on the side when you were racing, or?
Oh yeah.
You were?
Oh yeah.
How old were you when you started growing?
16.
16.
Yeah. My parents didn't support the whole BMX thing so much. So,
they didn't.
No, they weren't too into it. You know, just my parents were like driven on me getting an education, that being a primary focus. But seeing other people in different aspects of life doing pretty well, following their dreams, and I'd say more of like a blue collar work environment, I was seeing some people just excel so well at what they're doing without that education, just following a trade. And I knew, like, I had my heart set on BMX, wanting to start my own bike company, which is another kind of fun time frame in my life, which I got to learn a lot and carry it all over to cannabis. But at 16, I was running away from home a little bit. And then I was living with a buddy whose older brother grew. And I'd smoke here and there, but getting to see the plant, I was like, I was hooked instantly.
And so when you're going around the world, kind of, are you doing it on your own without your parents' help, and then growing cannabis on the side, were you growing at home, or were you growing at like a buddy's house?
I was growing at home.
Okay.
I just relied on a water reservoir being filled up by like a buddy or a neighbor, and then the cheap timers with the 15-minute clicks.
Yep. Yep.
And then calling a brother or something, or a buddy, and or having a roommate at the house, and just, we could be on two totally different time zones, and I'd still be making sure I call in morning or night and like, are they praying? Yeah. Is everything getting watered?
How did you do? Did you ebb and flow? Because a lot of everybody was doing ebb and flow back then.
Of course.
Botanic air trays, ebb and flow.
100%.
The rock wool.
100%. Yeah. Right?
That was like the go-to.
Yep.
How many lights?
I started out with four lights in a guest bedroom, and then did the 4x4 blocks. The same thing, the botanic air trays, the flood and drain. And then, I ran that system for like 2 or 3 years, and then started the,
that was like the go-to.
The go-to.
Yep.
Until everybody went to the buckets.
The ebb and flow buckets by R&M.
I think so. Yeah. With the hydrogen balls.
Yeah.
But a year of coming home, and that was the big thing, is like, you need your buddies to come over to help you wash your balls.
Yeah.
And just being in the backyard with the hose, spraying them and having a little assembly line. I'm like, what am I doing? You know, I kind of miss those times.
Yeah. A little bit.
We were like voyagers, you know, just trying to figure it all out. And everything was super discreet at that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Typically the buddies, I don't know if it's the same for you, you'd meet were guys at the hydro store. If you see another dude, instead of getting the little 1 gallons, he's got a bunch of 5 gallons on the dolly.
You want to step it up?
Yeah. Yeah. Or you see him there 2 or 3 times, you start opening up like, hey, what's up? What's your name? What are you growing?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You started a bike company called Decoy.
Yeah.
How did that go? And when did you start it?
Oh, I don't remember the year I started it, but maybe 10, 12 years ago. So I think I was like in my later 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just something I wanted to do. Like, BMX wasn't a super high paying sport. So some of your sponsors are the people you ride for. The best way is like almost like selling packs and making a royalty, you know? So if you're training kids at the track, or you're going on tour and you are meeting people, they'll give you like a promo code or something to try to sell the bikes. And then they go back and look through the data and be like, oh, all right, Brandon, all right, Derek, you help sell 20 frames over X amount of time. And just kind of doing that to pull my weight, I realized some of these guys didn't want to listen to the feedback by some of the pros on what would be like a better design or putting in the work for somebody else. I was like, I could do this on my own. And I wanted something that was USA made and that I could design and develop. And I've always kind of been business minded, you know, selling candy to kids at school at a young age. Like, I could do this myself and do it better.
How old were you when you started it?
Maybe 24, 25. Like, I took probably a little over a year of just R&D, finding different people to help me weld, get the metal sourced. I'd have to get like raw aluminum, get it annealed so it would be softened up, and then get it all bent and swedged. Cause I just didn't want kind of your standard out of the box stuff, which is what I felt at the time was my competition.
Yeah. I've seen some of your bikes for sale on the market that are like on historical, like BMX websites. Okay, and cool. Shit, dude. It was pretty sick.
Yeah. It was good times. I learned a lot. That was looking back at it, that was like the best chapter of my life, I think, for real life experience, getting to learn.
Yeah. Getting to learn how to run a business.
100%.
Yeah. Cause I think, you know, coming from the cannabis world, if you're just growing all the time and you're just moving packs,
yeah,
you don't understand about taxes, payroll, you know, compliance, all this different stuff that you got to worry about in business. So you getting that experience with your bike company and taking it into what you're doing now, it's probably really helpful.
Oh, 100%. Even employees and quality control and just kind of even learning how to deal with, somebody told me eating as much shit as you can, still being able to maintain your composure. There's always going to be somebody that's not happy, and it could be your fault or it could be something that just doesn't suit their liking, and being able to kind of digest that and walk them through into a happier scenario that you can still gain the sale, earn their trust, and leave with them, you know, having a positive experience.
Yeah.
And cannabis, I mean, it's totally the same way.
Yeah. Maybe you started at 24, and then what, how'd that bike company go? Do you still have it? What did you?
I sold off the tooling for the frames, which is like the main component of a BMX bike. And then I kept the name. And then the parts line, I sold off the name and all the property that went along with it. I think that was like coming into 2018 when I knew cannabis was going to be full recreational sales and legalized. That's where my heart was at.
Cultivating. Yeah. So you went in, you go from being a pro BMXer, making your own bikes, and then go into cannabis. What happened after you sold Decoy? You blew out the warehouse that you were?
Yeah, the shop that I had.
You feel comfortable talking about that?
I mean, yeah, it's all right. I won't really go into like depth with numbers and stuff, but all of it was like Proposition 2, 15 days. There were some hiccups with it as far as like legalities, and I ended up having to deal with all that as I rolled with the punches. And the city that I was in was actually like pretty forgiving. They wanted to see people go about things properly and actually apply for a license. They weren't considering Proposition 215 anymore to be okay for their city and all of their zoning and stuff. So I just took kind of everything I gained from all my years of experience, and I worked hand in hand with the city, and I just went forth on going at it legally.
Back in Prop 215, they were kind of trying to license that. I mean,
the city knew already, probably like in 2017, they had some of the zonings, what they would consider like an M1, which is mostly like in the industrial areas, but they had like a plan mapped out, and they wanted to gain revenue from tax. So leading up to 2018, like they laid everything out, and that's where there's been a couple of buddies I've helped out, is the city that you're trying to apply for a licensing, and it's no longer illegal. Like there's nothing to be embarrassed about. You can walk into the city office and just ask, hey, what is your zoning for cannabis? You know, some cities allow it, some don't. And they'll lay everything out in front of you. You know, sometimes at the clerk's office, they'll even print it out. Here's the zoning. Here's the forms. Here's how many applications are still left. They want you coming in there. They want your business.
Yeah. And how big did you go in that warehouse in the Decoy warehouse?
It was like a 5,000 square foot warehouse.
Okay. So like 100 lights.
Yeah. We ended up making it into putting in a mezzanine and expanding up to 100 lights.
Yeah. And then, you eventually got into retail.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Started that in 2018. The shop didn't open until about 2020. And then we got the micro business. We took a Rite Aid pharmacy, gutted the whole interior of it.
A Rite Aid.
I think it was actually called a Ken's at one point, a Rite Aid, and then a Ken's or vice versa. It was in the city of Moreno Valley. And we gutted the whole building and then did all our own TIs. One of my business partners is a general contractor. Dude is extremely rad, ended up becoming one of my best friends, and he's hungry, you know? So we built this thing in probably 9 or 10 months. And then we faced COVID like everybody else and had to deal with all the city inspections delaying, but we had trades on top of trades, and that building, in under a year's time, we were ready to turn it on, just had to wait for Edison for the power upgrade. But we took that building. There's, I think, just shy of 500 flowering lights. Got like 8 rooms in there. Veg. Moms. We do some manufacturing in there. And then in the front, it's a retail store. Coolest thing about the retail is you can see into 2 separate grow rooms. It's kind of a really neat experience, just coming from the side of cannabis where I wanted people to know about it, being the extreme sport, seeing so many injuries and people like everybody else, you know, they get on whatever script medicine. When I'm a firm believer, like cannabis is the way, it's a plant, no different than treating a burn with aloe vera is whether you smoke it or consume it. I think it's the miracle cure. So that's something that I like, we pride ourselves on is people can actually come into the store and there's some people that are skeptic about it at first, you know, maybe a friend or a family told them about like edibles or something being the entryway into their medicinal needs side of it. But actually being able to see the plant, a lot of people are like, so that's it? Those flowers are it? Oh yeah. Well, we dry them, we trim them. What's trimmed is, you know, it's taken, typically made into something and
you get a refined. Lot of new consumers.
Totally. And it changes their kind of their whole perception or their stigma of cannabis. You know, I'm like, it's not, we're not trapping it and gassing it like a potato for a fast food joint or anything. Like we dry it in a room with an air conditioner and a dehumidifier and then it's trimmed and packaged. Like it's very simple. It's very standard. And there shouldn't be a stigma about it being anything more than that, you know?
Yeah. 100%. And I've been to one of your grows a while ago and
oh, yeah.
you're very organized. Like you have a set process and you stick to it. Right.
Trust the process, bro.
I mean, yeah. So it's this like you're very meticulous, clean, and just set. How did you set this new grow room up? You have 8 rooms. Obviously you have 8 rooms for a reason. What was the reason around picking the number 8?
That's just kind of how we could fit and utilize the square footprint that we had with some of the like supporting poles that were inside of the building. But I just tried to maximize everything as far as our workload. We consistently cut down a room every 10 days. And with 2 drying rooms, that's kind of just a very simple formula that I can continuously replicate. Our nursery split into, it's all one, but we have usually 2 stages of plants in there. New development, new growth, something up to 16 days. We pull it from a room, reload it. So we want everything revolving.
Yeah. I see.
Trying to keep that consistency.
I see a lot of guys, you know, trying to, you know, it's so important for cultivations to be on a schedule, like a really tight, strict schedule.
Agreed.
You know, especially, you know, with labor and consistent workflow and drying space and flow through the facility or flow through your retail, like that consistent 10-day harvest and having multiple rooms. Guys that are, you know, back in the day, we'd try to do these big rooms, take all down at once. But where you really start to kill it is the schedule. It's that takedown every 10 days or whatever it is, whatever your schedule is,
totally.
Sticking to it. It's and building facilities that way as well.
Time is money.
Yeah.
I think one of the best helpers that I ever got to see is when Instagram first started up, you know, like I'm a absolute lover of the Jungle Boys and getting to see that they would, you know, show it in live time, basically like a photo uploaded today of them chopping up a room and refilling, you know, in the days where everything's Prop 215 and no one's really talking about it, I had friends that would dry in the same room that they would grow in, whether they're getting their own clones, however so, or buying it from a friend, that reloading a room, vegging in place, and then turning it over, they're like, yeah, 3 runs a year. We're doing 3 runs a year. And then, you know, seeing Jungle Boys go about it, it's like, nope, they have adequate veg space, the dry rooms, you know, it's like, these boys are on point and they're showing it to the world, you know, like, good for them.
Yeah.
And that just kind of gave me a little bit of reassurance. Like, all right, I am doing this right. You know, like time is of the essence in this, you know, you want that plant charging, you know, like things being docile for a bit just slows down the growth.
How many runs are you doing in those 8 rooms a year?
Just under 5.5.
5.5. So you are on point.
Yeah.
Like
I mean,
the max you can do is what, 5.7 or something like that.
Typically, like almost every strain we do nowadays takes us like 60, 65 days.
Yeah. So what you have your own bedroom.
Yeah.
And then you're moving them into the flower room and you're flipping them right away or you letting them veg for a little while?
Right away. Day one, we'll chop the entire room, bleach, scrub, get it all sano, and then put in new slabs, irrigate them. And then like second shift starts. So we'll split up the shift for that day. Usually 2 or 3 guys will start like a later shift and then they'll just bring in the plants.
500 lights. How many employees do you have?
We've got a team of like 14 people that trim When they get done trimming, they de-leaf, they do the teardowns and the setup of the room. And then we have five guys in cultivation, whether it's mixing salts, canopy managing, nets, just checking on the plants. The five guys that we have, basically, it's not so much labor that I'm looking from out of them. It's just more like the focus of having an eye on the plant. That's a big one that I see a lot of facilities that are struggling, or buddies that come in and want some help, or is like, hey, I think you're doing great. What's some of the things you have? Eyes on the prize at all time is like the easiest way for us to kind of stay on track. You know, I've heard a bunch of other dudes talk about it, but these rooms have so many components that are just running at, you know, 100% full charge all day long. Dehumidifiers, air conditionings, foggers, your drip system. If one of those things goes down, it throws everything off. And if our big focus point is light, temp, humidity, those three things go hand in hand with our irrigation. So if dehumidifier is not working, the AC is down, you know, we just see, looking at our data, whether it's a spike or a decrease in something, it's like, I think I can catch it a little bit faster having guys kind of working through the rooms and just monitoring things more efficient than just sticking straight to my data. We can catch it, I think, a little bit quicker. That helps us with keeping down the labor quite a bit.
Is that kind of your rule of thumb? One guy, one grower per 100 lights? Or that's just what it ended up to be?
I think that's just what it ended up to be, but
it's about seeing what it is.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, one guy for 100 lights. I mean, if you were back in the day, you say, oh, one guy will run 100 lights, you'd be like, you're tripping.
Totally.
But these days, I mean, you don't have a choice.
Yeah, and I think if you're really delegating that work properly and you have your scheduling on point, you can bring down that workforce tremendously. I watch guys putting on nets as plants are already getting so big, they're flopping over, and their game plan for the day is, oh, we're going to get two sets of nets up. And in my mind, I'm watching this and I'm thinking, why did you not have, you really need for these size of a plants, three nets. Why were two of them not up?
Already.
Let the plant grow through it, you know, and then just go, well, the plant's still soft and growing, you know, like start separating them and opening them up at a young stage. And we can take, you know, what should have been an 8-hour day at this stage and turn it down to 2 or 3 hours of labor with one or two guys at a younger stage. You know, it's just timing is everything.
How long is your veg time?
It's about 16 days.
16 days. And are you in Rockwell or Cocoa?
Rockwell. We do like a 4x4x2.5.
Okay. And you go onto a slab?
We go onto a slab after that.
Yeah. It's exactly what Jungle Boys are doing right now.
Okay.
Yeah. 4x4x2.5 onto a slab. Are you going on the slab in the bedroom or you?
No, when we chop, we'll set out slabs. Kind of everybody goes on lunch when we put in the drippers. And then I think it takes about an hour and a half and we come back and the slabs are already kind of all bleeding out, completely overfilled and saturated. And then at that point we put on the block, let them sit for a bit and then slice them and let them bleed out.
So are you vegging in place or you have a veg room?
We have a veg room. Yeah. It stays in the veg room for 16 days. Every stage has got its own room. There's a mother room, a room for clones, veg. And then the second that we chop, we take stuff from veg and put it right in the flowering room. And then the time schedule stays the same. If that room's running 9 in the morning to 9 PM, then at 9 PM, that room shuts off. The following day it kicks on and we call that our day one.
Now, with the 4x4x2.5, so you're vegging in those and then putting the slabs in the flower room and then planting those on top. Yep. And then flipping.
Yep.
Flipping same day.
Same day.
Wow. That's efficient.
It is a pretty efficient.
Yeah.
And that way I'm not getting plants that stretch so much. And that's where I kind of resorted back to the 2.5-inch height instead of the 4-inch. Because I noticed those 4-inches, if you got a healthy plant and it's charging, those things are monsters before you even get them into the room.
Yeah. Yeah. And so 16 days in a 4x4x2.5 and you're not having any problems, you must be watering multiple times a day. Are you going drip with veg?
Drip with veg. Yeah.
Okay.
Everything is, and that's something we pride ourselves in, is when we like set up our rows, we have everything kind of squished together in one row. And, for one room, it basically takes up 5 rows, in veg space. So there's 10 rows in there and then 5 at one stage, 5 rows at another stage, but we'll keep them all the blocks together for about 4 or 5 days when we put a plug into the block.
Just hand watering.
Hand water them once. Actually, to make it even easier, just put a clip with the hose onto the tray and I soak the shit out of the tray. Just like an ebb and flow. Let the blocks get fully saturated and then open the drain and then let them dry back for 4 or 5 days. And then after that, we separate. But our big thing is when we separate, we try to put them in stages. You know, row one is our smallest, two, three, four, five. And to the untrained eye, it looks pretty uniform, but that way, as far as our irrigations go, is I can kind of tune things into where I let them dry back a little bit more, maybe on if I had a row of some smaller clones, so that that way they get a little bit extra stretch. And that way, when it's time to set them inside of a room, I'm completely uniform.
Now, is that on the same bench or a different bench?
Each bench has its own irrigation.
So that's why I was asking, because it'd have to have a different zone.
Different zone, yep.
Okay.
So basically one row might get one or two less feedings, maybe the first 7 days in there.
Based on the height of the plant.
Based on the height of the plant.
Will you be able to get those plants caught up to the other ones?
Yeah.
So all those plants will go in the same, but you're just adjusting irrigation strategy based on the size.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. And yeah. One other tiny little thing.
You mean you got to be on your game to be paying attention to that.
Yeah. We've worked with the guys that are on the team for years on that. And it's like every guy takes pride in what they do. And that's where I've seen is our support team is just so good with all of the guys loving it. That's one of the things so exciting about cannabis is there's so much growth and it's so fast. And when things are healthy, they're even faster that it's hard not to be excited about to coming into work every day. You know, even the guys that have a 2 day break, whether it's their weekend or their midweek is they're excited to all come back in and like a relay race, you know, pick up the baton where you left off at, you know? So it's like, all right, Brandon, you did great this weekend. Now it's mine. Like I'm driven to help charge these plants.
Yeah. To have your back.
Yeah. And all the guys do that. That's a big thing is out of the five guys, we've got a group thread. Manager's on there. I'm on there. But at the end of the day, it's just a simple text, a group text. And all the tables, we've got a little tray that I made with a runoff cup. And then at the beginning of every table, I just put one pistol string in so I can get the volume, the total volume going into the plant, see what's coming out. So I'll get a report at the end of the day. Room one, you know, 1800 mils in, 400, 500 mils out. And then once or twice a week, we check pH and EC just to make sure that we're at our set points.
Now, are you checking that on the whole bench, on your runoff of your bench, or are you doing it for each individual plant?
No, on each bench, I've just built a little wooden stand so that I can elevate the slab a bit. Mm-hmm. And then I took a cloning tray. I cut two cloning trays, PVC glued them together, and I'll put one entire slab on that thing. And then get the total volume and divide it by three. For three plants on a slab.
Smart. I like that.
Yeah. And that's just very simple way. I've tried all the sensors and it's okay. It's just, I don't want to say it's good or great. I thought it was just better for the keep it simple, stupid method. I walk into a room and we know everything starts feeding, you know, within a 2 hour window of a room turning on and all of our rooms pretty much turn on at the same time. You walk into a room at lunchtime and you don't got cups in every tray filled with water. You know that we missed an irrigation, you know, whether somebody closed a valve or what it may be. But for us, that's, it was just more of a reassurance. And then even the group thread is trying to tell my guys all the time, like sign onto the, whatever system we were using, you know, and look at it, look what our water contents are at and start looking at the graphs.
So you're using substrate monitor and you're not?
Not anymore. No. I threw it all to the wind. I just thought it was like a little bit, I don't know what would be
unnecessary.
A little unnecessary, totally. And then trying to teach other people how it worked, kind of. They'd understand it, but then maybe they're focusing a little bit more on that than the overall health of the plant.
Yeah, no, I could see that.
I started having gaps in the room, in a lot of rooms where I'd see the growth wouldn't be where I'd want it. And some of the guys would be like, well, the sensors in this row say that the water content is lower than it actually was, and they're overfeeding it, and just the bite into the slab weren't what I wanted. I didn't see the resin production that I wanted, so I just went back to the old school method.
How's that? How's it working out?
Good. I just feed the plant till I feel like I have ample runoff, and then work on getting a good dry down. And then my personal experiences with Rockwool is just don't let it get too dry.
Yeah, for its channeling.
I think one time at the beginning is okay. And then typically everything resaturates back up. The slabs saturate really well, even if you go a little bit past where your set points are. But same thing with the 4x4x2.5 blocks is with the dripper on that. It's hard to overwater those things. The plant's charging. It's got healthy roots. You can have your P1 or P2 phase. And even without the sensors, as simple as having a guy walk through the room and just kind of feel him. And if your whole team's on point, working together hand to hand, you know what you're looking for.
How often are you feeding those 4x4x2.5s when they're in veg? Say, you know, you went through your 5 days, kind of established them, spread them out, organize the smaller plants with the bigger plants, put them on a different cycle.
Yeah.
On the larger plants, how what's the frequency of the watering and when do you start?
Those basically are like a P1, six, maybe eight shots a day for the first 3, 4, 5 days. I think they're a little oversaturated at that point, but I'm just looking at, you know, making sure I got good root development. And about by day eight, after the plant's been vegging for a full week, it's pretty mature. You know, it got a lot of big fan leaves on it. At that point, we'll almost every row is at about 8 feeds. And then we might have to do 2 or 3 P2 feeds so that when we come back the next morning, nothing's overly dry.
And it's important to let everybody know the only reason why you're able to do that is because you're using such a small media for veg.
Totally.
I mean, if you're using a 4x4, you would completely change that irrigation strategy.
Totally.
Even the 2 inches or 1.5 inches, whatever you're adding on.
Completely.
Would change that irrigation strategy completely. I mean, you'd go from 6 to 2 or 3.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's really important. And so obviously you're cutting down the irrigation strategy on the smaller plants, letting them catch back up.
Yeah.
With your runoff. And so you said you're cutting a clone tray in half, or, you know, cutting the end off a clone tray and putting it together.
Yeah.
Kind of gluing it together and then putting the slab in there.
Yeah.
What are you looking for on the runoff markers? Like on runoff, you said 400 mLs on runoff, or what are you?
So in veg, with it only being like one individual block on that, we typically go for like around 25% runoff, maybe 30% runoff.
Off of your input.
Off of the input.
Yeah.
Right. So okay. If it's getting 300, 350 mLs a day for that size block, I'm hoping to see like a max, maybe 50, 60 mLs.
Mm-hmm. And then what pH are you monitoring when you're checking your pH and your EC on your weeklies? What are you looking for?
Typically, like, we feed pretty much everything at like a 2A to 3O. Veg is at 2A. It goes into rooms at 3O. It's getting blasted with a little bit more light. I just feel like it needs a little bit more food. When it's in veg, because of it being a little excessive in runoff, not too crazy, but my pHs always stay, we go in at about a 5.7, and everything kind of always is fluctuating 5.6, 5.7, 5.8. So there's not much monitoring. I know if we do excessively dry back, let's say in one of the rows where I'm aiming to get a little bit more stretch out of the plant, rather than paying so much attention to pH, I'll pay attention to the EC. Because if you start having 2, 3, 4 days of more aggressive dry backs, I'll see the EC start climbing. And in veg, I don't want a 2.8 plant to start climbing into 5, 6, 7 EC runoffs, because it's only in that room for such a short period of time.
In veg.
In veg, yeah.
So you're looking for around...
For runoff on that, I want in between 5.6, 5.8 if we're feeding at a 5.7.
Okay.
So minus 0.1 plus a 0.1 is okay. And then, for my EC runoff, I'm hoping not to climb more than like 3 EC in it. So if we're feeding
for veg,
yeah, I don't want anything really over a 6.
Okay.
And if it is, we just add an extra P2, maybe 2 or 3 shots one day. And then we'll retest that one specific row the next day and be like, okay, you know, the runoff's now coming out at a 4, 5, or a 5.
Now, when you're going in and you're doing that initial drench on veg, are you hitting them at a straight 3 EC or on ProLine?
2.8, yep.
2.8 EC.
2.8 all the way through veg.
ProLine, cleanse, balance?
Yeah, balance, not really. I'd use...
tap water?
No, we use RO, but I use a general hydroponics, the pH...
Up.
Yeah, the pH Pro Plus up.
Okay. And so hitting them at a 2.8 EC right when you drench, then you're monitoring your runoff, making sure it's about a 3 EC on runoff in the clone trays you go together. Once you transition after 16 days of full veg into flower, are you taking that clone tray that you built and put it in the flower room as well?
Yeah, I have the same thing already built for the flower room.
Okay. And then what's your irrigation strategy looking like day one to flower to, you know, week one to week three?
Week one to week three, when we put them on top, when we put a 4x4 on top of a slab, I'll irrigate them for 48 hours with lights on. So, we use that open sprinkler.
Yep.
Which is,
that's what we're using right now until we get our grow lane hooked up. But open sprinkler is amazing.
It's amazing. No problems. And again, it goes back to the keep it simple, stupid. Everybody can kind of walk through it without a whole lot of instruction, you know, being able to actually click on things and label them however so, and build your irrigation strategies. It works out pretty darn well.
Yeah. Really simple.
So we'll go into 48 hours of feeding, you know, every hour. So you get 12 shots. We do like a 2 minute shot with a 0.5 gallon per hour dripper.
You use 0.5s, not 0.3s.
Yeah, I use the 0.5s.
Have you tried the 0.3s or?
I did. I get bothered by things pretty easy if the workflow isn't there. And then an open sprinkler setting up the timings to be, you know, 2-3 minutes apart. I don't want to go into it and have a feeding on at 9 a.m., 9:23, 9:46. Mm-hmm. This way I can just
shorten your feedings.
Shorten my feedings. And then if everything's feeding for 2 or 3 minutes, you know, and then instead of them being separated 20 minutes apart, really they're separated 18 minutes apart.
Mm-hmm. And as long as you don't dry them back too hard, you don't have to worry about channeling.
Totally.
So you got to be on it.
Yep. And there's been times, that's why I'm like a big believer in the slabs is there's been times where it's kind of, it's borderline, you know, and maybe I wasn't there that day and someone's like, hey, this room can hold off one more day. And we all come in the next day. Nothing's wilting or anything, but you could just tell they're praying and you feel the slabs and you're blown away. You're like, whoa, there's no weight to them. And even with one dripper on them, those things will allow you to resaturate them once or twice in a critical condition. I kind of going back to when I started and going from a 4x4 and then doing the ebb and flow buckets and then trying longer trays running like a Hugo, the 6x6. That seemed like it was the industry standard for a long time.
No, 6x6 was it.
6x6 was it, but there would be critical times where you're not there for a day and they dry down. There's no resaturating. Even if you go super slow with the wand and you soak it, 2 or 3 days later, it just goes back. It's a channeled out block. And then I like less is more. So adding one dripper, it's just a lot more simple than two drippers on a Hugo, making sure that way I get even saturation.
Yeah, the slab's your insurance policy.
100%.
Yeah. And when you're setting your drippers in your slabs, what's it look like in a 3-foot slab?
Three drippers.
Three drippers. And now are you going into the 4 foot, into the 4x4?
Into the 4x4.
Okay.
Pretty close up against
super simple.
Yeah. 25% away from the edge of the block, you know, close to the root system. And then we have everything on the backside of the block. So if my tray is facing, the drain on the tray is facing towards you, dripper on the back of the block.
Okay.
Centered.
Yep. Super simple.
Super simple. And then.
Yep. So 3.5s for a, you know, for a slab. 3-foot slab.
Yep.
On a 4x4.
On a 4x4. Yep.
Yep. And then, so going back to the runoffs, when you're collecting your runoffs in your trays, what are you looking for on EC? Cause it seems like your pH is really stable.
The pH is always pretty darn stable, you know, and that's another thing is why I became in love with your product is keep it simple, stupid. So adding shit all the time, like that was it. You used to go to the hydro store and it's like, names on some of these things, bigger buds, sticky buds,
it took me, we've known each other for a long time and you weren't always using Athena. It took me a while to get you on the team.
It did. Not too long. It's just, if it ain't broken, don't fix it.
Yeah, I get it.
And that's kind of where I got off of the sensors. It's like, I think I can absolutely crush it. Just knock it out of the park by just teaching my guys what we're looking for as far as weights and making sure if they're getting fed, they're all right. But running a 12 or 20 part system, adding this and adding all your cups and stuff, it's just, it almost sounded too good to be true.
Yeah.
You know, like you come over to my house with a couple bags of salt and A and B. And in my mind, I'm just thinking, no, this can't be right, you know? And then when you start kind of putting together some of the MPKs on the formulas of what you're using, you're like, I've got 6 bottles of half of the same shit in them, you know?
Exactly. It's we've been getting hammered our whole life, you know?
Yeah.
Just getting fully, you know, fucked.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
By every nutrient company.
Buying water.
Yeah. Buying water and separated into different bottles, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, that's why. It's what Athena was kind of like that first, you know, step into like, here, this is all you need.
Yeah.
And get away from all the bullshit.
Yeah. I won't say who, but I did try another company, and that's where I maybe took a little time to like lick my wounds, you know, and give yours another shot. Is I want all my reservoirs, I want all my drippers to be clean. I'm super, a couple people have seen the Instagram page, and I'm really big on filtration. I don't want to work harder.
Yeah.
Clogged drippers is just something that I've seen way too many facilities, or even some of my buddies' gardens. And one of the other powder formulas, I'd come back in a 24-hour period, you know, and what was left in the reservoir, you could wipe your finger on it, and it was just coated with sludge. You start opening up filters, and it's terrible. It's a mess. It's setting you up for failure, you know, and that's one of the big things is even when you gave me the samples, you know, is whipping them all up in a trash can, you know, I'm like, do I use it today? I'm like, no, let's test it out tomorrow. But coming in there and then just seeing that I didn't have all the fallout, you know, and then it was still clean. I'm like, all right. And yeah, it's
all everything that you've seen in your reservoir is going in your lines, and everything that it's in your lines is going in your drippers.
Oh, 100%.
It's got like when you're doing a 500 lighter, like you can't be fucking around.
Totally.
You know, and be out there trying to unclog drippers. What did I do? I came by and I dropped off some Perline. Is that how it went?
Yeah. And you're like, dude, how are you not using it? I was like, well, I'm a worrywart.
Yeah. Cause we're neighbors, and I remember you're using another line for the longest time, and I kept talking to you about it. Right.
Yeah.
I kept mentioning it, you know, and I was like, hey, like you got to get on it. And I think one day I was over and I just went to the office, grabbed you a bunch of product and dropped it off. Right.
Yeah. We were going to go riding or something. You brought me a bunch of bags. You're like, here, start using it. I'm like, oh man, I kind of felt, you know,
felt guilty because you're like,
yeah, I'm like, he's my boy.
He's my neighbor. I ride dirt bikes with him and I got to run it, you know, I got to try it out. Yeah.
But it was instant success. And since then I've, you know, got a bunch of dudes on it, and it's pretty cool. When people come into our facility and they're like, well, you've got all these tanks. How come it's just filled with water? Like, I thought you're supposed to use a bunch of chemicals for growing pot. I'm like, well, you need fertilizers. Yes. I'm like, and here's what we use. It's super simplistic. And they're like, well, how come if these are the tanks for the room, there's no fertilizer in it? I'm like, it is. Here's our RO holding tanks, you know, and they're extremely light blue. I'm like, and here's my feed tanks. I'm like, they've got like the tiniest little shade to it, you know, because I know you don't use dyes, but it looks super clean to the untrained eye. It just looks like a normal storage tank of water.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, really clean. Doing liquid fertilizer is a walk in the park to powders as far as manufacturing.
Yeah.
Because you can get away with less quality inputs, less raw quality of inputs on a liquid, because you can filter the liquid out once it's, you know, mixed and done. You do a filtration process and then you bottle that. Right.
Right.
But when you're going with powder, like powder formulas, it gets the quality of inputs have to be another level, over liquids. And a lot of companies don't understand that. A lot of, you know, nutrient companies, they don't understand, like, you cannot change an input. Like, if you change where you're sourcing your raw material from, if you get in a crunch you're done. I mean, you're going to have not always, right? But a lot of the times, if you're going to change your raw input or change where you're sourcing products from, you're going to end up with sediment. You're going to end up with all these problems, and then you're going to get something like you were saying earlier. It's got to be consistent, always the same raw inputs. And that's what we really focus on.
Yeah.
So going back to the runoffs, what do you like to see in that transition week of the first few weeks of flower? Are you still seeing a 3EC, or are you climbing up a bit?
No, I start climbing up a bit. Kind of about 2 weeks in is when I start seeing them climb. I don't really check that first week, because after we go 48 hours of being on the slabs, I'll take 3 to 4 days of letting them dry back, wanting the roots to really chase into that slab.
Drying harder.
Yep, drying them pretty darn hard. So it's been a while since I did check an initial runoff after an immediate dry down. But to me, that's completely invaluable. You know, I the plant's looking healthy. I know that my EC's probably skyrocketed because it's dried for so long. I mean, even 3 days in a slab, your pH is going to be shifting quite a bit. So as long as my plants are really looking healthy, I'm not really checking my pH or my EC runoff until about 2 weeks into flower. That's when I kind of start again.
Okay. So if keeping I see it really simple.
Yeah. Keep it simple. Like, again, we just look for plant health. You know, if everything's super green and vibrant and praying and the plant's thriving, it's charging. You know, I'm getting a nice tight stacking on it. A lot of branching. It's super vigorous, you know, like not saying look the other way, but I don't need to break into things pretty good. What we will do is we'll just grab an X-Acto blade on a couple slabs. I'll bring a tape into the room and we'll cut the side of a slab open and just making sure that the rooting process is really well and the roots are kind of like scaling and trying to develop as much as they can throughout the block. And I'm running the one dripper. I've had actually a little bit more success with that. I've seen other dudes on Instagram that have, you know, two drippers in it and maybe they get an even watering, but for us on that smaller block, it looks like it's getting saturated pretty darn well to where it's got even distribution.
Just with one dripper.
With one dripper. The whole entire slab is very well saturated. You know, the stalks of the plant are charging to where 14 days in, they're on a full irrigation where every day they're getting, for our facility, 1,500 to 2,000 mLs per plant. The stock on the initial plug is now starting to break through the 4x4, you know, and the 4x4 is starting to split a little bit. They're biting in so well to the slab. And then from day 14 on, we check once or twice a week, the pH and the EC. And I really don't want to see the EC climbing more than like 1.5 to 2.
Over input?
Over the input every week as we go throughout.
Okay.
And then typically, we start our flushing at day 50. I tailor back on the nutrients kind of like at day 45, we start dropping the temps and the humidity a bit. So then it's like the plants, its response is it's not wanting to eat as much. I can't put the same volume in or my runoff will just be like extremely dramatic. I'd be overflowing these cups. So we drop the EC back. I typically will fill up a tank to 400 gallons instead of the 500 gallons and then just top it off with 100 of RO water to dilute it.
Okay.
And then my pH doesn't change. My EC would then go from a 3.0 to a 2.0, 2.1, 2.2. And then we feed the rooms with a little bit less irrigations. So then maybe I'm chasing for 12 to 1500 mLs per plant versus our 15, 18, 2000 mLs if the plant's really charging.
What are your frequencies that you're running on irrigations when you transition to flower? Are you still going to 6 to 8? Are you going up?
We're probably at like 10 to 12 shots.
10 to 12 shots for how long?
For 4 minutes.
4 minutes. Okay.
4 minutes. The half gallon.
Okay.
Half gallon per hour dripper.
And do you adjust that based on cultivar or?
Totally.
Yep.
Just kind of see
how
where it's at.
Drinking.
Yeah, and then. Someone will set like an alarm in the phone, you know, if we're aiming to get 8, 10, 12 irrigations, you know, by the time we're supposed to get maybe irrigation 8, if we start at 8 a.m. and we are feeding every 20 minutes by like 11:30, maybe we'd set alarm. So 2.5 hours into the irrigations, we'll go into the room and just see like, if we're starting to really, the slabs are bleeding. We already know like, hey, we can cut back and then just a light hand feel sporadic here and there throughout the room and just kind of see like, hey, all these plants are saturated. Big thing with the trays is you've got all the crevices through the trays that you can look down. If I'm already seeing all of the slabs are bleeding and I've got ample runoff, I know like, hey, I don't need 10, 12 irrigations today. I can cut it back. Open sprinkler, baby. Just -1, -1.
That's awesome.
And then monitor it.
And you're never changing your irrigation times. You're just changing your frequencies.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then if a plant's really charging, then without a sensor, we kind of go into that P2 strategy. So we've got one room. I have no idea why, but it's just charges harder than the others. It's like our big banger. So when there's a strain that's a big yielder, we always wait for that one specific room.
I bet you has to do some with climate.
You know, even with all the sensors that we're using and trying to go back through the data, no one can put their finger on it. And you know the definition of insanity.
Yeah.
There's mornings that I go in there. I'm like, all right, I'm going to get there before anybody. So I'm undisrupted, you know, and half hour before the lights kick on, I'm sneaking into the room, feeling stuff. Got my hands up, feeling temps. And I just can't put my hand on it. It's the miracle room, you know, that's the one where we've got like our highest yield. And, if we've got a new cultivar that we're going to put in there or whatever strain it is that we're going after, that's a big yielder. We wait for that room because it's like, if we're trying to beat our objective, it's like, that's the room. That's the banger.
What are you averaging a light on yield?
Just shy of like 3 pounds of light.
Okay. That's great.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And you're using HPS, right?
Everything's mixed.
How does that look?
Great.
No, I mean, what's how does it look? Checkerboard or you
check, one line of HPS, one line of LED, HPS, LED, HPS, LED, so that everything's getting a throw and kind of mixed, like a mixed spectrum.
So you're going one full line on LED and then one full line on HPS. Do you see a difference in growth of the plant on height of the canopy or?
Not really on height of the canopy, but loving my own personal batch. I'll see under the HPS, the plants that are stretching, the tops might have a little bit more of their definitive characteristics. You know, they might calyx a little bit harder, have a little bit more spike. The frost, I'm thinking, is a little bit greater, you know, the trike
on
production.
The HPS.
On the LED, actually, a little bit more color. But the HPS is something where the plant, I just feel like if you're going for look only, like that's the photo opportunity one, that the HPS just gives a little bit something special, you know?
Yeah. What about smoking? I mean, what do you prefer smoking on, LED or HPS?
I feel like they're real close because I don't really like to smoke the tops. I like to smoke 6 to 10 inches down. I feel like it's a little bit more chirpy.
Okay.
Everybody I know wants a top. So when we're trimming, I'll go into a room and I'll pick, you know, what would be like the secondary tops, you know, something that had just a little bit less light so that I get a little bit more flavor out of it. I feel like the smell's a little bit better. And then I'll trim those up myself in glass jars so that, you know, my personal batch is a little bit radder to show the buddies. And
Did you listen to the podcast we did with Bean Fiends?
Yeah.
What did you think about what they were saying about LED and HPS? Because you're already on it, right?
Yeah.
And you're already doing it.
Yeah.
So what did you think about what they said about, you know, the climate and increasing, is that what you're on now?
Yeah, no, totally. They're on point with it. And that's what's so cool about growing is like everybody is just so open to kind of telling you their experiences. I don't think things are so far advanced right now that where people are like trying to keep everything super secretive.
Yeah.
Because I could hand my recipe and my SOP plan to the next person. And for some reason with the same strain, it could look completely different. The TLC, you know, is a big factor in that, but I think light temp and humidity is a big one. And even having a mixed spectrum, you know, having to adjust what the temp and the humidity is it's just a different balance point that you got to find out what works best for you.
So what made you go the LED and HPS mix light in the same room? Like you obviously were on it, right?
Yeah. I wanted some savings, but, Gavita originally, when they came out with those like 1930s, I got a buddy that started working at a hydro store 15, 18, 20 years ago, and we've kept in touch. So him as a rep at Gavita, he's always been like super rad about giving me stuff to R&D. Going back to the bike company, he knows that I'm really big on just writing things down. If we tweak anything, even our irrigations, we record it. So if that room's banging, I know at the end, you know, less irrigations or we adjust light intensity at a different day than what our SOPs are or temperature, whatever it may be. We record it so that I have something to go back to. And because of that, he knows how a little bit anal I can be on all that stuff. So he likes R&D.
Yeah, very, very meticulous. Like I said, when we started.
And I got no filter. If something sucks, you know, like even in my biking days, you get a sponsorship by somebody. They want to give you something that's garbage, you know, it's like, that'd be cool to have a couple $100 of a paycheck from this. But if it's trash, it's not going to help me to win.
Yeah.
So R&Ding the stuff, you know, like I'll be very blatant about how it's working, but the 1930s seem to be really be rocking. The plants are charging, but in one of the rooms that I was going to R&D in it, they only gave me half the amount of lights. So like, we're allotted to give like 40 lights per person. So it's like, all right, well, rather than me putting the room half and half, let's just give this a whack. You know, we'll do every other row and just, if it works, I'll buy more and switch them out. But it works so well right off the bat that when it's time to update the rest of the rooms, I'm just thinking, again, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
And we did, in our R&D room where we try different strains or whatever, phenos that we're trying to do in-house or our own strains, it's an all LED room. That room to me still doesn't smack as hard as the mixed spectrum.
Wow.
And I think part of it too is those HPSs, the amount, the heat load that it has, it's drying out the media so quickly. And then the airflow throughout the room is just changing over so fast that.
Because the heat load,
you know, you don't have to do all the, like when I first started, I never knew about people adding humidification to a room.
in the HPS rooms, typically, you know, in the black market days, people struggled for a home grow to put more than a mini split, you know, like it was really hard to sneak a five ton on the, an extra five ton on the side of your house and have a handler in a six or eight light bedroom. So heat was naturally a factor from those HPSs, which the plants would transpire and there, it would be humid just from that. But an LED without adding any sort of humidification, I just don't feel like they transpire as much. So we have to add that.
Doing every other row balances it out.
It balanced it out. Yep.
Wow. That's a trip, dude. That's like, it's crazy that I didn't know that that's what you were doing, you know? And I heard about, the first time I heard about it was doing, the checkerboard was with Bean Fiends. I didn't even know that's what they were doing, 'cause they were keeping it super secret for a while. And to hear that you're already on it.
I think I was one of the first dudes on it.
I know.
It's been
I think so too.
It's in one of our viewing rooms. That's kind of what, you know, the guys at Gavita were like, well, you're going to show it off, right? That's the big thing, is it'll be in one of the viewing rooms. And people that were into growing were tripping, you know. You get the good with the bad. People that come in there and they got something to say, and there's other people that just have the love for it. But some of the guys that grow, or even our faculty that has their own grows, are like, why are we doing this? You don't think that that's weird? I'm like, what do we got to lose by trying, you know? Like,
it's working great.
Yeah, and it worked for us.
Now, are you using the Gavita double-ended 1,000 watt?
Yeah.
Okay. You can't even buy them anymore. I mean, so now we got to switch to another double-ended. I think there's a few companies making double-endeds anymore, but
yeah,
nobody really. Like, not it's not significant.
No. But luckily, since we pulled about 200 and something out of the facility, that we have them in storage. So
just have some extra.
Yeah, if something takes a dump on us, we can swap them out.
Yep. And now you're going to under canopy. You're adding that.
Yeah.
How's that going so far?
So far, so good. Walk into another buddy's grow, it was just night and day difference. Like, I was blown away with how little they were bottoming or lollipopping or cleaning up the bottom of the plants. Like, he was on a Hugo, my one buddy in particular, but they only cleaned up maybe 6 to 8 inches of the plant. So right at the starting height of the under canopies, and the buds were absolutely amazing. I was joking with him, like, I'd rather smoke your bottoms, you know? And
yeah,
the terp production on them was out of control. The color on them was out of control, but actually seeing a plant that literally had quality buds all the way through, like, you just don't really see that too often, even with stripping of the plants, you know, like, I've seen guys that go so crazy with de-leafing and the bottoms just are never quite as big as the, you know, the upper 25% of the canopy, but the proof is in the pudding. Those things are smacking.
Is your AC, adequate enough? I mean, probably because you're using the LEDs. You got some extra AC to back up the under canopy?
We do. I'm fairly new to the under canopies. So like, the longest I've had them in a room now is about 8 to 10 days. I just got them.
Okay.
And I went all out. We're going to do the whole entire facility. Like, I'm sold. But I haven't got it to where the plants are just charging so hard and transpiring so hard that it can't keep up. Like, right now it seems like I'm in good shape. So,
okay. So you just,
fingers crossed.
Hey, you just threw them in and was just like praying. Like, this is not too much of a heat load.
Yeah. You got to learn as you go. But, we kind of oversized everything to the smallest amount, but what I would need if there was like an influx in the plant count for the room, or, you know, increase in yield, so that way I'm a little bit over than under. But we have a little bit of power left in the building. So even though I have to do another transformer and step down and set up for the under canopies, if need be, we'll just add another air conditioning to each room.
What brand did you go with?
We went with Kraft Farmers.
Did you?
Yep. The same buddy, he bought a couple of a competitor's brand, and he only had, I think, six of the other brand. And then he had like half of the room with the Kraft Farmers. He's like, I'm just waiting for some more of the Kraft Farmers. Like, look at the difference. And in the one room where he had six of the other brand, they look good. The whole rest of the room didn't have the under canopies, and it was night and day difference. And I mean, he's got room.
He did a side by side.
Oh yeah, room one and room two. So it's like I could swing open both doors that are catty corner and look inside and just really notice. I was like, this room's got a third more weight in it. Like 100%. There's no fooling you. you have the bud, the color in the buds was night and day difference. The bottom of the plant was so purple and the buds were so big, it almost looked like they were 2 weeks further into development. But then, you know, if I had my blinders on and I only got to see the upper half of the canopy, it was the same.
Are they the same watts between both competitors? The 120 watts, right?
I think. I just saw a significant difference. So I didn't put too much time into researching the competitors. And I think Lance is a super rad dude, you know, craft farmer. He's just, he throws it all out there, you know,
He does.
Two other dudes in this game build a Patreon where, you know, you can follow everything step by step. Like, I don't think a lot of people understand the value of that. Even if you think you know it all, how much you could learn, or just how much of a caveat it is for that reassurance. Like, you know what, dude, this dude's crushing it and he's doing the same thing as me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because a lot of dudes fake the funk. I hear some wild numbers out of buddies all the time, you know, oh, we're now at 4 pounds of light. And I'm like, all right, sweet. So you're getting 400 pounds out of your 100 lighter. They're like, oh yeah. 2 days later, I get a message. Does your shop need, we've got 195 pounds of this and 25 smalls. I'm doing my numbers. I'm like, that's not 4 pounds light. But
yeah, yeah.
If you want to fake the funk, that's all right. And Lance doesn't. He throws it out there like it's all real time. You get to see it, you know, writing a question and getting support back. Like, not a lot of dudes do that. And I heard a quote a long time ago, you know, like, greatness doesn't fear greatness. And some of the people that I've looked up to in this industry, dude, they put it all on the table. Like, here's what I'm doing. You know, like, I want to see success in the next guy.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't want to see anybody fail. You know, like, I'm the type of dude when my buddy gets a new toy, I'm like the first dude, like, call me when you get home so I can check out the new truck, or, oh, you got a new jet ski. Let's see this thing. You know, like, I don't want to be that dude that's like, fuck, this guy got the new jet ski.
Yeah.
Like, no way, dude. No, like, you want to be pumped for your boys. And those people that are just putting it all out there, like Lance, and it's like, he doesn't know that guy that he's helping out, but what does he have to lose by sharing his wealth of knowledge to the next dude? That's the love of it.
Even before he had the under canopy, he was always sharing the knowledge.
Yeah.
Like, just always sharing it. And it's the same thing, Ivan, from day one. He just never held anything back. And, you know, back in those days when Ivan was doing that, everybody had their own little secret recipe, which was like a blend of like GH3 part and some other shit.
Of course.
You know, and that was their secret recipe that they wouldn't want to let out. And it's just, Ivan was just never like that. He, you know, and Lance too. He's just, here it is. This is what it is. This is how I'm doing it. Like, you know, Ivan put, the Octobubbler. Remember the Octobubblers?
Oh yes.
That was the initial one.
Oh dude. And I still,
take the guts out.
I owe that dude for that one. That changed the game, dude. I was a slave to the wand, you know?
Yeah.
Or trying other, whatever Home Depot bought drippers, but,
It started with the Octobubblers, then moved into the Netafim pressure compensated drippers and then that's it, dude. I mean, I don't think we're ever going to change from that. Like that's the no be all.
Who knows?
I talked to Roach about, doing under canopy, and he just put some in at Jungle Boys, and they went from 2.7 to 4.2.
Stoked.
On a tray. I'm just like, holy shit, dude. Like, that's insanity, you know?
It is, but it brings the love back into this. A lot of my buddies I joke about, to me, this is extreme gardening. This is still a sport, you know? Like, everything is so controlled that you have all your set points that you get to manipulate the environment, your irrigations, the plant to grow to your desiring. It is, I think, very extreme. But year after year of chasing the dream of beating your number.
Yeah.
It's extremely repetitive. I can't beat my lap time. I can't.
Yeah. Now you're about to beat your lap time.
Oh, and I'm always excited to come back into work. I think the work environment that we have is great. All the guys love working. So we do a lot of joking, maybe sometimes too much, but we have a good time.
Yeah.
But now being able to strive for a bigger number, it's like, I'm jonesed to get up and get going and just think like, I'm going to beat that number.
Yeah. Well, now you're definitely going to beat it.
Yeah.
You know, because there hasn't been any big, you know, changes as far as, technology or increasing yield in a long time. And I think under canopy is one that's going to be a big change.
Yeah.
It's going to change the game for a lot of guys.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And maximizing the square footprint right now is key. Cause for everybody that's not in California, I know some other states are taxing pretty hard, but wow, California is squeezing us we're seeing, you know, some brands that aren't thriving as hard as they should be, you know, starting to throw in the towel. So now being able to maximize that footprint, you know, squeeze a little bit more juice out of it is, it's great, you know, and it's very minimal on cost. You know, people see these lights, oh, it's $200, but simple math, you know, even if I took it at a, with a grain of salt, you know, and people online are saying 30, 40, 50% increase. Okay. I'm going to get a 20% increase. Well,
what's that mean?
Yeah, dude, a 20% increase on what you're getting. If you've got a room that's got 10 packs out of it, now you're going to get 12 packs out of it.
Yep.
Those lights are going to pay themselves back pretty darn quick.
Yeah, in the first run. Yeah, in the first run, it'll pay itself back. Yeah. So.
And you can just chase the dream of boosting up those numbers.
Yep. So you have one location in Marina Valley.
Yeah.
Called Sipkoi.
Correct.
And are you guys doing another location?
Yeah, we have in San Jacinto, which is pretty close to a neighboring town, our second facility going. It'll have like 225 lights. It's another micro business. We'll have retail there also. It's been fully built and ready for well over a year.
What's been the whole licensing? Or?
We've got the state licensing, but the city, the conditional use permit, fire and CO2 is a holdback. And in that city, they sub everything out to a third party.
Oh, so you're just...
I'm at their mercy. Constantly a new fire captain or new fire chief comes in. Somebody new from the third party that's working with the city for all of our corrections looks over it. And everybody knows it's not a quick feat. We'll get a correction back. And I'll look through the email and be like, dude, it says right here, resort back to page 10. Like, we made that correction. They didn't open up all the pages and go through it. But by the time I get that back, I could be waiting 30, 60, 90, weeks, 90 days. Weeks.
Yeah.
And this is just a vicious cycle that's been going on, you know. The building's beautiful. It's just sitting.
How close are you guys?
I was told January 1st of 24 by the city that 100% we'd be on.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So who knows now?
Oh yeah. Because on December 14th, I was already taking thousands of cuts.
Yeah.
I was like, January 1st, we're on. Nope. Flipping breakers, stuffing it with plants. And that wasn't the case.
I mean, there's a lot of guys in this industry, but you know, I don't, it's hard to make a profit, right? With taxes and regulation. And it's, you know, I'm sitting back and I'm watching you and you're doing great. I mean, you're profitable. I can tell you're profitable. And I can tell you're running a good business, but I don't think, as far as meticulous and paying attention to the garden as like you are, I just don't think there's a lot of great cultivators out there, but you've got to be on your game. Like you can't, there's no, back in the day you had rooms for mistakes, but it's just, those days are over
completely.
Like, it's you're on it. I could tell.
Thanks.
So
it's all for the love of the plant. I think that's one of the coolest things is how many friendships that I've got to make through this is I think the guys that are killing it, when we all get together, none of those dudes are talking about the level of success financially. Like, yeah. Oh, my new boat, my new this. Everyone is more into, I've noticed quality go up. I've watched yields go up. It's the overall success of the plant and the love of the plant.
100%.
And it just takes me back to my BMX days is, you have the dudes that would be at the top of the game and they never snubbed anybody that was struggling to make it or wasn't at the top of their level. The love was there for the common love of the sport, you know, yeah. Or now of the growing of the plant is everyone just wanting to share their knowledge of wealth. It's like, what's better than that? You know, to me, I think with everything else on Instagram, all these fad diets and just learning about, you know, we've talked to some of these other things about, you know, how you can stay in great shape and such, yeah, but yeah. The natural endorphins that you get from levels of success to me, like I get a way higher dopamine fix out of talking to a buddy and then seeing their success or someone that comes in and gives me a point or two and seeing some success and coming back and seeing something thriving than I do making money. Like I want to see a plant thriving.
Yeah.
My wife thinks I'm crazy. You love the plants more than the kids. You'll have the AC running for your plants more than at the house.
No, I think I truly believe if you want something in life, if you give first, yeah. You receive. I mean, whether it's you want financial wealth, give somebody, you know, financial wealth, you know, give something away and the success will come. I just, I've always believed that,
totally.
You know, it's a biggie. Yeah. What's this? This is, you made this.
Yep.
What is it called? Clone Dunker?
Clone Dunker.
Yeah. It was pretty sick though.
Thanks.
I mean, this thing's pretty sick. So what, how did you start this? When did you start it? Maybe simple, like, simple, but it, I mean, you could see it. Yeah. It's great.
I'm just like a weirdo. In my free time, I like designing things and trying to develop things. So there's
like bikes. Yeah.
Totally like bikes.
Thing, now the same thing.
My kid's into baseball. So I got a few things and patents I'm working on for that. Okay. It's just, I just enjoy it to stay busy. And I've seen a lot of facilities, even our facilities, part of the SOPs was like Dunkin' clones. It took forever. It was a waste of time. A lot of the times I thought our clones were healthy enough that it wasn't needed, but it was just also a reassurance of going through the clones and separating them again, just a redundant waste of time. Okay, great roots, not so great roots. Maybe let these things be in the dome for another couple of days. But hand dunking an individual clone couldn't be a greater waste of time. So I just thought, how do I get these things? Because I tried, you know, where I would tilt the tray and try to dunk them and then half of them fall out. Just a bunch of like little ghetto maneuvering. So a buddy of mine that helped me out with some like CAD and SolidWorks stuff from my bicycle days, I got in contact with him again. I was like, hey, do you have time? Can you help me put something together and develop this? And he was all game for it. And we bought a 3D printer and just started making prototypes. Prototype after prototype, just making sure that it clipped onto the tray real snug. And actually what it is, it's a tool that will, it'll slide through all your clones. So for a 50 count clone tray, it slides through really well. It snaps onto the tray and locks all of the one by ones or like AOKs into all the plug trays. And then you can completely flip the tray upside down and submerge the entire clone. And takes a couple of seconds.
And what are you you doing IPM?
Yeah, we do the Athena IPM. I'm just a big believer, you know, that kind of bugs got their own natural defense. So it's like,
so it's just part of your regular SOP.
SOPs, yeah. We'll do it twice. I typically will start doing it like day 6 to 8. And that's where I got into the next step of developing this, is there's kind of like a lip or an edging around the whole entire clone dunker tool to where the dome will sit on it, but it allows like some, you can see into it, it allows some sort of venting. So now I get a little bit of airflow into the tray because, you know, you got the two little flaps on top, or I've seen people recess and offset the plastic dome so that you get some more airflow, trying to harden them off a little bit quicker. But this allows it to now get air.
It's super simple.
Super simple.
How much is it?
I think I'm going to be retailing it for about $20.
$20?
$20, yeah.
Yeah, dude, totally worth it. And how is using this and dunking your clones, it sounds like you're doing it twice.
We do it twice, yep.
Do it twice and then you transplant into veg?
Transplant into veg, yeah.
So do you do it right before you transplant into veg?
I'll do it the day before, and then typically, so the clones will be 12, 13, sometimes 14 days.
Yeah. So it's preventative. So you're always doing it.
Completely preventative.
Yeah.
Completely preventative. And the clones like absolutely thrive.
Now, what's your bug pressure and PM pressure that you're seeing? I mean, when you're doing this process, I mean, yeah, knock on wood.
Yeah, but things are pretty good. I don't have any issues as far as our moms. So for this to be the end all tool for somebody that has an absolute infestation,
no,
they may struggle a bit.
Yeah.
Or they might have some success dipping the block. I typically don't want to dip the block. I'll just go completely into the stem, reaches the block as far as the dunk. But yeah, the pressure there, we typically will not even spray in veg, or if we do spray in veg now, it might be once every other week.
Okay, that's because you're starting off so well. I mean, that's the big thing about IPM. IPM works great as a infestation, but it works even better as a preventative.
100%.
You know, so if you're just make this part of your regular SOP, where you're following this dunking before veg, then
yep.
You know, we spray twice a week in veg, IPM, and then we spray up to week 2 or 3 in mm-hmm. flower, just twice a week. Yep. And then the rest of the flower cycle, nothing.
Yeah.
You got nothing because you did all the work on the front end
completely
before you had a problem.
Completely.
And that's exactly what this is. You know,
it also works really good for shipping or transporting clones.
Yeah, you're right.
It locks them in.
So this actually locks down in a regular Mondi tray?
Yeah.
So this will lock them down. So completely. You can ship a whole 50 cell tray.
Yeah, you could look like Jim Carrey in Ace Ventura with the package. I don't know if you remember that movie where he's throwing it around.
Yeah. And it just, no problem.
No problem. That's where I was like spent so much time is making sure, because the Mondi tray is a little bit flimsy, but kind of the prongs on that are great enough to where it'll really hold on nice and snug to the tray.
Yeah, right here. It just goes right under.
Yep.
And then you flip it down and lock it in.
Flip it down, lock it in. So just you see that. Slide it through, grab it on the open-ended side, and then press down on it. It'll clip in the other side.
Who's going to distribute it? What are you thinking?
Maybe direct to consumer. Maybe my buddy at Athena.
I don't know. I think maybe. Is that why you brought it? Maybe.
Nah, I just kind of wanted to show it off. Like, is this something that's kind of exciting?
I think it's sick. I think it's sick. It's simple. It's affordable. You know, and it works. Have you? Thanks. Mainly Mondi, or any other trays?
Yeah,
I forgot. It on all of them.
Yeah, there's a. Grogen sells another brand, but it's very similar and it will snap onto it too.
Okay. So it works on multiple brands of trays.
And I'm kind of developing the 72 count. The problem is that because of the thinner spacing, having the actual fingers that lock it in, it's not as tight of a lock.
On the 72.
The 72 is, and then I'm kind of just looking at what industry standard is.
50 sells better, dude. I mean, 72 is too compact.
Yeah.
It's too compact. 50 is like that perfect.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't want to go more than 50.
Yeah.
On a tray. Like I always liked 50.
And those fingers are big enough where a lot of people don't actually put the stock into the punch out of the plug, but they offset it. You know, they actually stab into like the side of the wool, you know, or away from the circle to cut out the punch hole in the middle.
Yep.
And it's still big enough to where you can slide it through. You know, you might have to give it the tiniest jiggle, but no one's going in there and breaking. You have to be careful, but with the 50 count, no matter how you plug your starters, it'll fit and hold them.
How many can you produce in a day?
Well, there's actually a company out of Corona. I paid for them to have the mold. I did all the CAD filing of it. And then from China, they got the mold, but now everything will be manufactured in the US. So I think it was a ballpark of they can produce 5,000 pieces of plastic injection molding in a day.
Okay. All right. Let's have a meeting after this about it. See what's up.
Cool.
That'd be dope.
Cool.
Yeah. I think it's pretty sick. And for shipping, it's a game changer.
Yeah. That was the other one is that we got the perforated boxes so that hopefully you can stack them up.
Like these?
Yeah. Cause it got overwhelming when I started picking some of these things up.
Where did you make this box at here locally?
Somewhere back east. Okay. I'm not sure what state, but it was a company I found online that would do a full cut to size with digital print, all 360 degrees.
Okay.
But trying to stack these things up, you'd be surprised, like a couple thousand of these things.
They're heavy.
Oh, it'll take up your whole airplane hangar.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, do you have a whole airplane
hangar? I got a bunch of them already.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. So it's like, I have to get boxes so that I could stack them because if you stack them up just on plastic instead
of... You need distribution.
Yeah.
Yeah. And marketing. And we got that.
And that's something I'm not the best of, you know, like I don't pride myself in that. I don't try to like fake the funk. I stay in my own lane, you know, like I'm not great at marketing. I'm not great at,
well, dude, you're running a 500 lighter and a retail store, and then you're opening another 200 and something lights in another location, another retail store.
I mean,
you only have so much bandwidth.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot.
I enjoy my family. That's another one. It's like, I'm a big family man. I'm like super blessed. I got two boys. They're healthy. They are extremely rambunctious.
Yep.
They love playing sports. So it's like, I try to divide my time as equal as I can between work and play.
Yep.
So
what, you know, I'm always interested, through your struggle because, you know, you started at 16 and you started in an interesting time, like a lot of us, right? Started growing weed when it was, definitely gray.
Yeah.
Have you had any challenges with law enforcement or anything growing up through the industry?
Yeah.
Feel comfortable talking about it?
I mean, a little. I just don't want to, what would it be? Like throw myself under the bus, but
don't throw yourself under the
bus. Yeah. You know, like my facility, got raided and we got issued a bunch of fines. Luckily everything was dismissed other than like being handcuffed and released. I didn't have any real criminal charges.
That's good.
I've been pulled over with a bunch of work and had the proper placement, paper trail, and all the legalities of the Proposition 215 day in place, to where a police officer kind of just looked at me like, I don't even know what to do. Like, well, here's my giant folder. According to how many, you know, members that we have, you know, with all of their recs, it's like, this is how many plants I can have. This is how many pounds I can have.
There you go.
Do the simple math. He's like, you seem knowledgeable, kid. Like, go. And looking back at, you know, I'm already a short guy, but when I was 18, I was looking like I was 14. So driving a truck around loaded with packs, yeah, like, probably wasn't the smartest idea, but, rolled with the punches, you know, like,
dude, class. How big was the spot that got hit?
That was the 100 lighter, the 5,000
square. Oh, yeah. That was the 100 lighter. Yeah. The 5,000 square feet.
Yeah.
How did they find out?
Somebody else in the complex is doing the same thing. And, a kid set a dab rig with the e-nail,
mm-hmm,
and I guess it fell over and he went on lunch break and it lit a coffee table on fire and his whole building went up in flames, but he had fire sprinklers. So the volume of water
let it out.
Oh, these out of the garage bay doors, these guys had leaves just bellowing out the door. So it was a dead giveaway. And then after that, they did like a sweep, and it was, I think, three shops in there in total. So the one that got popped for having the fire, and then two others, they came and they raided.
Were you there when it got raided?
I was not, no.
But they came and hunt you, tracked you down?
Yeah. And then I just showed up too because one of the neighbors told me, like, the code enforcement already knows who you are. I met code enforcement. He was like completely okay with it. Just said, hey, do you have your paperwork in order? They even allowed for us to go and get fire sprinklers. So I had a fire sprinkler company come in, put in fire sprinklers. And then I passed a code.
This was prior to getting raided.
This is prior to getting raided.
Yeah.
So they knew about it. So in my mind, I'm like, this is Proposition 215. You know, like, I'm allowed to do this. It's medical marijuana. So I didn't really have a whole lot of fear, but just one morning, you know, I got ADT calling me, and then I sign on to my cameras and there's no cameras going on. And then a neighbor at another building, a good buddy of mine who builds some like fancy cars and stuff. And we took a liking to each other, and he knew what I was doing. He called me and just put me on blast right away. This is what's happening. You know, one of your beloved workers he's handcuffed in the back of the cop car. Like, you got to come show up. And by the time I did, it was just code enforcement there. They released the worker that I had, and he laid it all out. He's like, all the fines that you have are in the building name. Like, the city wants you to go forth with the license. They just want you to do it properly. And it was kind of a relief. You know, I'm like, maybe I'm doing things in a gray area. I didn't know, but now knowing that the city is like wishful of this and is willing to help me, you know, it was a relief, you know, like, rather than always like kind of like looking over your shoulder, am I doing right? Is this the wrong thing? You know, because part of this is I got started. My younger brother got paralyzed from motocross. And when, rather than doing the opiates, it's like, we got him on pot and we got to meet so many other people who were like, oh, you know, like our kid can never smoke weed. And, you know, we grew up in like a religious household. My mom's like, that's the devil's lettuce. No one's smoking pot. And now, you know, I've changed her way of thinking. She's like, wow, like, your brother was a raging psycho when he would take his medication that's all prescription based, you know, like uppers and downers. And then now it's like, he rations his weed. Like, he smokes a couple times a day, maybe not even a gram of weed a day, but it's like, he's on pretty much no prescription medication at all. And when there were so many other families, you know, we had families of like young kids, 12, 13, 14 years old. They're like, we heard from somebody in room 102 down the way that they smoke pot now a couple times and they're getting better. And this is in the rehab facility. And, I'm like, well, I can't give it to you. I'm not giving it to a minor, but yeah, but totally, like, I'm seeing the like the healing benefits of it. So, I wanted to be like an advocate for marijuana, you know, and when it became legal, like, I was super excited, and I was already kind of telling people because of what happened to my brother and, you know, trying to work on funding and needing help from a proper architect and engineer and people to help me establish this. Like, I couldn't do it all myself. I needed somebody in my corner. I needed multiple people in my corner, but having to kind of relay my story to them, and they're like, oh, okay, I've heard about weed and the medical aspects of it and it helping people. And like, really, really, like, you could just see the motor turning on a lot of people. Like, they're like, this is legal now. This is real. Like, this is the wave of the future. it was cool. Like,
yeah,
it was just an awesome time period, and not having to worry about it anymore. And now being able to like track all my sales and properly pay all the taxes and being able to actually like work on upping my revenue and making it profitable. Yeah.
Without it.
It felt great.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. So you're doing a great job, man.
Oh, thanks.
Congratulations.
Yeah, dude. Thanks a lot. Yeah.
Good job. And, looking forward to seeing that second store open.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Very exciting. I hope so soon.
Big win. Appreciate you making it out.
Thank you for having me, dude. And, great. Congrats to you on all your success too. You know, like,
thanks, bro.
We're just a couple of young dudes with the dream.
Yeah.
And,
how old are you?
37.
You're 37? Okay. I'm 39. Yeah.
And that's one of the rad things. Like, I think we're some of the younger players in this game, but when I get to talk to people, just letting them know, like, living the dream is, you can't have any entitlement. If you want it, it's so possible to get it, but mapping things out and having a realistic goal, you know, and really having a vision will help you out. Because when I started this, I had goals and I had a vision, but how realistic they were, really realizing that I needed the proper people to put in place to make my goal and vision work, could have been detrimental if I didn't open up to people, you know? So
100%.
Other people trying to get into this, you know, like, there's still time. People say it's oversaturated, but like, if you really have the love of this plant and this is your dream, you know, like, it's not too late. I still see this as like a prohibition phase, you know? It's like, put in the time. Don't be afraid to get in there. Even if you got to work for somebody else and show your worth, you don't know it all. There's still development all the time. 20 years of growing, I still love learning.
Yeah.
Somebody that's doing it a different way and I see successful, I'm an open book all day long. I want to take in their plethora of knowledge and learn from them. And I just still think that there is a hefty time period of people that are younger that see this coming up. If they're afraid to get into it or think, I will never get that chance. I thought I would never get that chance. It's going to take zillions of dollars, you know, but the proper game plan and being open to people and asking for help is you'll get people in your corner that are going to want to help you succeed. Also, You got to put in the work, you know, yeah, like
got to put in the work. You got to be organized.
Yeah. Even for you to get here, you know, I've gone over your story with you too. You know, like, you don't go from nothing to something overnight. It's the putting in the work. Sometimes it's a stepping stone. You know, you got company number one or job number one leads into job number two and three, but that love and that passion, it'll get you there.
Yeah. But yeah, I think something that I've really learned the past few years is just be patient. You know, things take time. You know, obviously you got to put in the work, but also things aren't going to happen overnight. You just got to take your time with it, be patient, and not rush to make decisions. That's a big one, dude. I mean, think about, you know, you have a great partner, Chris.
Yeah.
You know, you guys are best friends right now.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's a key pivotal moment is picking your partner. It's the person you're going to be married to for the next however many years or longer. Right.
Yeah.
So it's when you're making big decisions like that, you just got to slow down and take your time with those decisions, you know, not rush it.
I agree.
I really appreciate you coming on, and I really enjoyed the conversation. It was good.
Yeah. Thanks, Brandon. Yeah, I appreciate you having me here.
Thanks, bro. Appreciate it. See ya.